Brussels. This is tape 358, and the date here is October the 13th, 1978. The importance of Mrs. Jack Sullivan dying in a strange way after being able to get some information from her husband, who is programmed, similar to Candy Jones being programmed by the CIA, comes or leads the path to Sedona, Arizona, where the allegations are made that it's in this town that the brainwashing is done, or one of the many places for the Central Intelligence Agency, in the town of Sedona, Arizona. I know the area well because my boys went to school there at Verde Valley, and when we went to visit them at the school, Marina Oswald was in Sedona, Arizona. And if I were as smart then as I am now, I would have made a point to try and see her, and if she was sequestered away and knock on the door of the apartment where she was staying and try to find out what was going on. But I was pretty dumb in those days and was totally unaware of taking people off and doing memory jobs on them or erasing their memory. There is a lot of research being done into the murder of Mrs. Jack Sullivan, and I'll get back to that with you at another time. In alphabetical order, I mentioned Vice Admiral Rufus Taylor being murdered, and under that is Donald Edward Toback. He was in San Diego, questioned by the FBI the day that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald. David Ferry was questioned by Jim Garrison in New Orleans the day after John Kennedy was assassinated. Mr. Toback was engaged to be married the day that John F. Kennedy was shot. And after that, in 1976, he was stabbed 12 times. His ex-wife was from a South American company, worked with a travel agency based in San Diego, and he seemed to have had some links to the Jack Ruby connection of killing Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, Officer J.D. Tippit was shot in the Oak Cliff section of Texas in Dallas the day of the assassination, and that sacrifice of Tippit was the excuse to arrest Lee Harvey Oswald, who was probably told to go to the theater. Mr. Marchetti says that that's a common CIA place for people to meet in theaters and exchange messages. It's dark, and he probably had instructions to go to this particular theater. Clyde Tolson, companion of J. Edgar Hoover, his housemate, he wasn't at home the night J. Edgar Hoover was killed, even though J. Edgar Hoover was always in the company of somebody. Tolson died in 1975. Hoover died in 72. Carol Tyler died in 1965. She was the secretary to Bobby Baker and a long associate of Lyndon Johnson, protege of Lyndon Johnson's, or vice versa. I heard Baker on television making it out that Johnson leaned on him. They had a very cozy relationship in influencing Congress and wheeling and dealing in Washington, D.C. Carol Tyler died in a plane crash in 1965, and then her roommate, who worked for Senator Smathers in Florida, the roommate's name is Mary Jo Kopechne, died in an automobile accident and was drowned in 1972 in Chappaquiddick. She switched from Senator Smathers' offices to Robert Kennedy's, and then after he died, she was with Ted Kennedy, and then Ted Kennedy's car was at Chappaquiddick, and Mary Jo Kopechne was found dead in that car. Gary Underhill, CIA contact agent, high contacts in the Pentagon, knew who killed John Kennedy. He had said that he was sure they would get him. He died of gunshot wounds shortly after he said that. That was one of those early deaths in 1964. The series that was written up, the primary deaths in 1964, Gary Underhill was very important. Marilyn Delilah Whaley, W-A-L-L-E, a stripper, Jack Ruby's died. And as I mentioned on the other tape, Buddy Walters, I'm down to W, the Dallas police officer who found the .45 caliber slug in the grass where John Kennedy was killed, died of gunshot wounds in the line of duty. Dr. William Wolfe, next-door neighbor of George de Morenschild, died in 1963, and General Walker testified that he was a psychiatrist and suggested he use some kind of mind control. Now, he may have been the man who worked with de Morenschild and Lee Harvey Oswald, the control of Lee and Marina, the mental part of it, the drug part of it, like Dr. Kroger with Freddie Prinze, It was General Walker who called attention to the fact that Dr. Wolf knew something and was right next door to George de Morenchild, and that he burned strangely in the first floor apartment where he could have gotten out. William Whaley, the cab driver that took either Lee Harvey Oswald or Oswald's double to the Oak Cliff section, died of a car crash, similar to Karen Silkwood's car crash when she had information on atomic poisoning and uranium leakage and so forth in Oklahoma. Hugh Ward died in 1964. Another important witness, associate of Guy Bannister, who worked with the FBI and the CIA, associate of Dr. De Lesseps and Morrison in the New Orleans area. He died in a plane crash in 1964. James Worrell died in 1966. He's the gentleman who saw Oswald or the Oswald double. If one was leaving the front of the building, then this was the double. And Worrell is the man that was behind the Texas School Book Depository who saw this 23-year-old man leaving, and he died in a motorcycle accident. General Clyde Watts died in 1975. He was General Walker's attorney when Howard Duff made statements and wanted to tell the Secret Service that he had seen Jack Ruby at the home of General Walker. He was threatened and fled and went to Oklahoma and stayed with Clyde Watts, who allegedly got him a job. And he called his wife and said, call off the Secret Service of the investigators or I'll be killed. Coincidentally, or whatever you call it, Watts has never been asked these questions about Duff before the Warren Commission. And, of course, Watts died in 75, so he couldn't be called before the House Select Committee. But Howard Duff was never found, and neither was the Secret Service called to present this information. Abraham Zapruder took films in front of the Texas School Book Depository that have gone on to become the most famous home movies in the world. He worked at the Dow Tex building. He was a friend of Lyndon Johnson's. He was a member of the white Russian community. I believe he died of cancer. I always suspected that this story that he went home and took his daughter, a secretary, and just happened to take pictures that day is open to question. I really believe, just as every conspiracy has its author in residence ready to write the official account, that it's very possible with the links that Abraham Zapruder had that he was taking these movies, not that they'd be used by anything in the world like the Warren Commission. There would be a Texas Court of Inquiry that would go into the case. The FBI had solved it within 48 hours. Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin. District Attorney Wade had solved the case. For all purposes, the Dallas police and the FBI had solved it, and if there hadn't been a lot of clamor around the world, there'd be no Warren Commission. But by having a man record the killing of John Kennedy, he just simply photographed on one side of the street what took place, a car going down the street, a man is hit, his head's blown off, and he passes. It reminds me of taking pictures, the CIA, of E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis in front of Dr. Lewis Fielding's offices that they're going to burglarize later, or Adolf Hitler taking detailed pictures of Auschwitz, of everything he did, and records of who they did in, and keeping diaries of it, this fanatical insistence on keeping photographic records of the event. And I think that the reason the Warren Commission didn't use any of the other film available across the street, and Richard E. Sprague has gone around the country for years giving lectures on the photographic evidence on the John Kennedy assassination, about 25,000 different slides, scenes from movies and pictures that were not used. And I think the reason they didn't call in any of that information and only used Abraham Zapruder's film of the actual killing of Kennedy was that by standing on the side of the street that he was on, you couldn't get a view of anybody up in the sixth-floor window or not being in the sixth-floor window. It's possible that another camera across the street might have seen pictures of people in the roof or in the fifth-floor window or somewhere else in the Texas School Book Depository, because there were other weapons in the Texas School Book Depository, and also at the Dow Tex building. It was only because the researchers in the United States, many, many researchers, just like myself, made an effort to collect information, develop their curiosity, and pass along to other people, correspond, long-distance telephone calls, get articles out, read each other's material, write books, get to know each other, and form a body of critics that could be available to have this accumulated evidence. And it was through these efforts that these pictures were procured. The more pictures were obtained, information was obtained about assassins or alleged assassins being taken away. They certainly weren't arrested. Their names weren't taken. There were many suspects at Dealey Plaza, and I can run those down for you at another time. But the value of the pictures is important. The fact that they didn't use them is important. But Abraham Zapruder, who was a crony of Lyndon Johnson's and a member of the white Russian community, died of cancer, and it was his pictures that were to be used by the Warren Commission, and those were the main ones they depended upon. Jack Zangetti died. He had knowledge of Jack Ruby's role in the conspiracy. He died early, right after the assassination in December of 63. He was in Oklahoma. He might have known Clyde Watts or Howard Duff there. He knew the days before that John Kennedy was going to be murdered. He was found in a lake 2 weeks later after Kennedy was killed. He had said that the kidnapping of Frank Sinatra's son would take place to take the heat off the John Kennedy assassination, that it would be a fake kidnapping as a diversionary. And since learning about Jack Zangetti's statements on that matter, I've tried to follow other news events that I've mentioned on the tapes that I think were done to divert, such as when Gerald Ford is running for president. There was that tree chopping incident in Korea that served in his favor because two American servicemen were cut up by Koreans there, and carried a lot of news. It gave him a chance to be patriotic. It gave him a chance to say, well, send in troops and we won't allow this. He could be on the brink of war and go back into Southeast Asia. And it made Gerald Ford the statesman and the warrior. And then the night that Jimmy Carter was nominated was the night of the Chowchilla bus kidnapping. And that, again, took away from Jimmy Carter or free press statements or interviews later. You'd have to buy time between the nomination and the election. But he had all this time because he was a fairly new person. But the Chowchilla kidnapping came just at that time. And he was put off the news for what they called that year the biggest news story in the country. So these diversionary tactics, I suppose I'm just citing two, and the Sinatra thing would be three. But maybe we could add up. If we had a computer someday and could feed information of big disasters and political events, and the proportion of weight that goes to those events that are simultaneously with the politics and the election year, and just see how much is diverted from the major candidates who would need the attention at the time. Eugene Zwart is the last death that I have on this list. Secretary of the Air Force, was stationed in San Antonio. He had arranged John Kennedy's trip to San Antonio. He knew of the plot to kill John Kennedy. He had talked about it. And similar to George de Morenschild and Carlos Prio Siqueiros, in the fashion of organized crime or whatever, when you talk, you get shot in the mouth. And Eugene Zwart was shot in the mouth. There were other witnesses, such as Lauren Hall, who went to Washington to give information on the assassination, who said there were threats on his life after talking to the committee members, and Reverend Brochiers, a roommate of David Ferry, who got calls, don't talk or cooperate with the House Select Committee. This was in 1977, or you'll be killed. Wilma Tice, who saw Jack Ruby at Parkland Hospital, and Seth Cantor, the writer, confirmed it, was getting threatening calls. It would pay to keep your mouth shut. And Aquila Clemens, a witness to the killing of Officer J.D. Tippit, said it would be best if you don't say anything or you might get hurt. There are incidences in the 26 volumes that I have in my files of many threats to kill people, but that summarizes up to this day the witnesses, major witnesses that are dead that would have provided important information, and I think they should be all put in a book someday, in one book, and relate the story of the Kennedy killing through the eyes of the people that were killed. Those of you that don't have that position paper, I call it just the position paper that I wrote in September 17, 1976, on how to set up a committee to investigate the assassinations, you can send me $2. That's what it costs to copy the paper and the postage. The postage is high these days, and the 13 pages plus the postage. And I'll send it to you because in analyzing the House Select Committee, I'll take certain points from that paper and refer to them and then get back to the House Select Committee. But it isn't absolutely necessary that you have it to understand the analysis because as I take the points, they are parts of that paper that I did write in 1976. It was a personal item I wrote to send to members of Congress investigating the assassinations and various people that were interested in what I considered the basis for a good investigation. Now, first on that list in solving any homicide, I believed and still believe today, is are the primary witnesses killed? Who killed them? Because as you begin to examine evidence, the evidence isn't as important as the witness is killed, for the reason that only certain evidence then is presented and not the whole story. Had other people lived, we may have more evidence, and being as that there's so many deaths surrounding these cases, we're limited to what's available. But the second most important thing in investigating assassinations is the material evidence. Now, that is what makes any homicide fairly easy to solve or difficult to solve. If you have the gun or the clothing and you can test the bullet direction, how far the bullet came from the person who was killed, what direction it came from, was it entry or exit, and analyze the types of bullets through these pieces of evidence. The pieces of evidence can be the human body or information on the scene or letters or documents. The clues to the puzzle are the pieces of the physical evidence, not the opinion of a witness, what they thought they saw and heard, but the actual physical material that is picked up by the police or Secret Service and FBI and law enforcement. The pieces of evidence are the objects, not what they talk about or think they saw or heard. And on the paper, I said that the second point after the deaths was investigating pieces of material that have been destroyed, that have been altered in some way, that are missing. We don't know for sure they're destroyed, but they could be in another file. They are delayed. In other words, an example of delayed evidence is the Rolleiflex camera that Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have used to take the pictures of himself in the backyard at Neely Street, but it wasn't among his possessions at Mrs. Payne's home or Beckley Street. In fact, it wasn't located for 2 months to be tested, and then it was at his brother's house all along, and they came up with a camera that should have been tested immediately, because later new negatives could be shot with that camera, and then it could be positively identified with that camera. The investigation I wrote, this is in 76, into who killed our leaders can never be solved or explained unless a committee spends a day or two in full committee listening to what physical evidence was destroyed in the hands of the FBI, the Dallas Police, the Secret Service, the doctors attending the autopsy or at Parkland Hospital, or other persons from the Navy, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agencies. They should go down, one, item destroyed, John Kennedy's brains. Two, date it was destroyed or discovered missing. Okay, Kennedy's brains were put in formaldehyde. They were to be tested a few weeks after the assassination. For all purposes, the only person that I know that brought up the fact that they should be tested for the kind of bullets that went into them to see if they matched the other bullets in the body or car was Dr. Nichols in Kansas City and Cyril Wecht in Pennsylvania. And when Cyril Wecht tried to get to the National Archives, they said the brains were missing. And I think Dr. Nichols had tried to get at them, too, for a long time. There should be a statement, a clear sheet of the importance of this evidence, what it would provide. In other words, when they get on national television or radio and say, oh, John Kennedy's brains are missing, but two bullets did all the damage at Dealey Plaza, went through John Kennedy and John Connolly, it should be pointed out that there are many bullet fragments in the brain, and the brain is gone, and therefore we can't confirm positively that there were not more bullets at Dealey Plaza. The importance of it is that it could show two gunmen and with extra bullet fragments missing that J. Edgar Hoover tested in 1964, those could be still different. So that, and a shell picked up off the ground at .45, or a shell picked up by Mr. Hicks at Dealey Plaza, there could be five different guns. The chances are, if it was a well-planned conspiracy, there'd be some similarity. But being as they had a backup team to do all this picking up, they didn't have to be so careful, and as I say, they never expected the Warren Commission anyway. So there should be a statement of the importance of the evidence. In other words, when Kennedy's brain is missing, there could be more gunmen. Then another point is who saw it last. And that briefly came up at the House Select Committee hearings. And the opinion was that Robert Kennedy had it in some kind of a little box and gave it to Mrs. Lincoln, John Kennedy's secretary, and maybe he just wanted it done in. And evidence that was altered, they should go into who had their hands on it. How was it altered, such as the Abraham Zabrud or movie films of John Kennedy being assassinated, were turned around and put in the wrong order. In the Warren Commission hearings, they were published in the wrong order, and much of the evidence that was destroyed was never accounted for. How it was picked up, who saw it last, why they took it, who gave them orders to take it, and this is all important in terms of evidence. So in the hearings of the House Select Committee, it is last month already, it was a week ago, pieces of evidence were missing, and the various witnesses talked about it, and the panel just sat there. That's why I call them the bunch of eunuchs. They can't show any emotion or feeling. They've all been psychologically sterilized so that nothing matters. Richard Helms went on to talk about the CIA file of Lee Harvey Oswald in the John Kennedy case, that Lee Harvey Oswald had a file there and that 39 pages were missing. Nobody said, well, where are the other pages? Let's see the other pages. What do they have about Oswald and the Soviet Union? He simply said 39 pages of the 201 file are missing, and Jan Diaz in Los Angeles, a longtime researcher who worked for the Defense Department, said that Oswald had to work for the CIA to have a 201 file. And Richard Helms said, go on and call Navy intelligence. He didn't want the whole blame, but those are missing. So they talked about the 201 file missing, Kennedy's brains missing. Then they talked about the bullets that were tested by J. Edgar Hoover in 1964 that no longer exist. Now, I think that is enough to just close shop right there. I mentioned it before a couple of weeks ago. I just can't believe that this one gets passed off as a credible story, that anybody can accept the two-bullet theory after hearing that neutron tests were given on fragments that were in John Kennedy's car in 1964 that are different than tests in 1978, and that pieces of bullets from 399 and from John Connolly's wrist were tested in 1964 and are different weights than those tested in the laboratories in 1978. Dr. Vincent Gwynn from NASA had testified that in 1964, Connolly's wrist bullets were tested at Oak Ridge National Laboratories. Two weighed 2.3 milligrams, a third weighed 1.62 milligrams. But in 1978, Dr. Gwynn got a container from the National Archives with assurances this is all the metal they had from Connolly's wrist in their possession, and that they were two different pieces, that this time one weighed 16.4 milligrams, and the other weighed 1.3 milligrams. J. Edgar Hoover's tests in 1964 were not conclusive. They were called inconclusive, and I'm sure that the reason he didn't produce them is that at that time they would have shown that there were extra people shooting in Dealey Plaza in addition to Lee Harvey Oswald. In 1978, the committee was given bits and pieces of metal brought out by the National Archives. This is from the Washington Post, September 9, 1978. Not one of them matched the FBI test. The pieces didn't include the earlier Hoover bullets, and they were different weights. They didn't include any of the specific pieces analyzed by the FBI in 1964. I find that pretty shocking. They were also given bullets that were supposed to come out of Army Major General Edwin Walker's home, and they couldn't concur or positively say that Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle shot in the home of General Walker. They could say it was extremely likely that the slug was from a Mallinckrodt Carcano, but they couldn't say positively, and neither could the Warren Commission. And they were forced to admit this time, Robert Blakey, as I say, that the brains were missing. There was also a picture as part of hard evidence. There was a photograph presented by Robert Groden that I talked about on earlier tape of what was supposed to be a man at the Daltex steps up there at the fire escape at the building directly behind President John Kennedy. This building was in the line of shots. According to Dr. Barger, the area of shooting could come from the Daltex building. He confirmed there was a picture of the man in the window shown by Robert Groden. But when the photographic experts wanted to put down the conspiracy theorists, they showed photographs of Dealey Plaza and Grassy Knoll and said there could be no puff of smoke there. They didn't see it. They showed a picture of what was supposed to be a man on the curb, and it was trees. They showed the picture of another man on the concrete wall that was, in fact, a man, but they couldn't confirm the rifle. But when they ran down all their evidence, I didn't see them rule out a man at the Daltex building. They left that out completely, which is horrendous, because, as I said, Eugene Brading was there, a member of organized crime, a man who had been at the office of H.L. Hunt on Wednesday, Jack Ruby was at the office of H.L. Hunt on Wednesday. So was Connie Trammell from the CIA, the Republic National Bank, with their CIA funding and black money. This man was in the Daltex building so that when the experts had the evidence that a picture of a man was standing in that stairway at the Daltex or behind the stairway by the window, that is what I call evidence ignored, because they're not choosing to use that to come to conclusions, and I'm sure their report will not go into the photographic experts analyzing the Daltex building. Correct me if I'm wrong. Let's wait and see what the report comes out, because it would, in fact, show a man, and it might even show Eugene Brading there. We don't know. But as long as they're hiding something, they hide it good. They tease you by saying, here's a photograph of a man on the step, and then they followed up hoping you forgot that by saying, we didn't do tests to see if it was, in fact, the man. John Connally's clothing and John Kennedy's clothing were brought very dramatically into the House Select Committee hearings the day, 2 days that it was televised. We had the picture of John Connally's clothing so that they could discuss the direction or that the hole went into his coat and exited. It went into his shirt also and exited out his shirt and went into his wrist sleeve and into the thigh. The clothing was used to show the trajectory, the position of the bullets from John Kennedy into John Connally's body, even though they never analyzed the hole in the thigh, that the position the bullet was in to get into the thigh, or the wrist position, the way it traveled from there. And they also had this hard evidence on the television screen, but didn't say that it had been destroyed by dry cleaning. They never used it as evidence for entry or exit, but simply used it for the holes, instead of calling in the people who destroyed it. That's what I tried to say in that position paper, and I didn't make it. I don't know if I made it forceful or clear enough, but where did the chain of command break down? Who had the garment? Who sent it to the dry cleaners? When was it dry cleaned? What would it have told us if it hadn't been dry cleaned? What would we know that would help us stop John Connally from becoming president in 1980, maybe? Also, the bullet 399 was referred to during the House Select Committee with no reference that it had blood on it or flesh on it. When they talked about pristine, they meant pristine cling. They didn't only mean particles of the bullet were gone, but there was no sign it had gone through a body when it was found at Parkland Hospital. And the finding of bullet 399 was never identified as having come from the stretcher of John Connally. They kept referring to that bullet. And this is important because there was so much talk about bullet 399 and the direction it made, and yet they couldn't identify where it was found. And if it was found on John Kennedy's stretcher or some other stretcher at Parkland, then that changes the story of the assassins, of the trajectory, and so forth, because if it was planted there, then the other information would probably have to be looked at with closer eyes and more scrutiny. The medical x-rays of John Kennedy were not seen or examined, and when Dr. Morton Halperin wrote about them in 1967, they weren't available. So there is even the question now of whether the x-rays, if they were to be examined by objective persons, would in fact be the same x-rays that were taken when John Kennedy was assassinated. The car interior that I've spoken about many times was removed. We can't tell what bullet fragments were in that car or how many because it was ripped out. The shell of the car remains. It's up in Michigan. And I was told that there would be indications that bullets did indeed go back into that back piece of metal that would be seen from the inside. Notes taken in the Dallas jail, and there were notes taken. There was no stenographer, no tape recorder, but there were notes taken. According to witnesses in the Dallas jail when Lee Harvey Oswald was interviewed, and those notes are not around anymore. They were destroyed. Now, the simple conversation that Sheriff Craig had with Lee Harvey Oswald and James Hostie in Captain Fritz's office, where he said, people will know who I am now because I did get in that car that honked, that belonged to Ruth Payne, opens up a whole new view of the assassination of John Kennedy, the officer, killing of Officer J.D. Tippit, and then Lee Harvey Oswald 2 days later. Just the few words he said that sneaked out that got in the commission hearings were enough to whet the appetite of researchers, and that's why those notes were so important. And, of course, the original autopsy notes were burned, and Commander Humes gave the excuse at the House Select Committee that they had blood on them and that he had to destroy them. These things are dictated. A man doesn't put his hand into the bowels or head of a body and get blood all over it and then start writing notes. There were many, many people in the room, and his autopsy reports were dictated and were not covered with blood. If they were, it was the messiest autopsy report he had ever done. But I think he was lying. I think it'd be nice to put his voice under some kind of a stress machine. I don't believe his notes had that much blood on them. The post office application of Lee Harvey Oswald, when he lived in Dallas, Texas, was destroyed. Postmaster Humes testified it was destroyed. It's supposed to last 2 years after a person changes their box, or it's a federal crime. Nobody was ever prosecuted, and that would be important, because if a gun was ordered in his name and he didn't receive it, who was receiving it and who signed for it and whose name was on that box, in addition to Lee Harvey Oswald's, was a name added so that the name Alec Heidel could receive mail, because that post office application is no longer around, and if the name was there, it could be erased by ink and be photocopied later to show you that only Lee Harvey Oswald got packages there. But in fact, the rifle came to Alec Heidel, and the post office slip was destroyed. We're out of time. I wish I could do more on this destruction of evidence, but we'll have to do some more at another date.